Welcome to our deep dive, into Lamentations chapter 4. We're really going to unpack this chapter that's raw, painful, and honestly pretty tough to read. It's almost like a punch in the gut as we confront this brutal aftermath of Jerusalem's destruction.
It is. It really is. It's like we're standing with the people of Jerusalem in the ruins of their city, feeling their grief and confusion and anger.
Yeah, for sure. So we're dealing with some heavy emotions here. It's all wrapped up in this funeral lament, right? How does chapter 4 fit into the bigger picture of the entire book?
Well, think of it this way. It's a crucial pause before the healing can even begin. In the previous chapter, we saw this mentor figure urging the congregation to turn to prayer. But here in chapter 4, it's like everyone takes a step back. They're not quite ready to pray just yet. They need to revisit the trauma and to feel the full weight of their loss before they can even begin to process it.
That makes sense. Grief isn't linear, is it? It's unpredictable and messy. You can't just force yourself to move on. Sometimes you have to sit with the pain for a while.
Exactly. And this mentor figure understands this. He's like a wise friend who patiently walks alongside them, letting them grieve at their own pace. And it's this empathy that really gives the chapter its emotional depth.
Yeah, I'm also struck by how the structure of the chapter seems to mirror this emotional roller coaster. It feels like we're thrown back into the chaos and violence of the siege, especially after the more introspective tone of chapter 3.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Chapter 4 acts like a bridge, connecting the raw lamentations of chapters 1 and 2 with the prayers of chapter 5. And we're back to the stark contrasts you see, the poetic descriptions of the good old days juxtaposed against the horrific present.
Yeah, and those descriptions are pretty vivid, sometimes overwhelmingly so. Like the image of starving children, their tongues stuck to the roofs of their mouths, unable to even cry for their mothers. It's just
The
heartbreaking.
chapter uses such powerful imagery to really convey the depth of their suffering. It even compares them to jackals and ostriches, animals known to abandon their young, to emphasize this utter desperation and abandonment they felt.
And then there's the description of mothers driven by starvation doing the unthinkable to their own children. It's hard to even fathom, but the chapter calls them compassionate. It's such a jarring juxtaposition. What's the significance of that word choice?
I think that one word, compassionate, speaks volumes about the impossible choices people were forced to make during the siege. It suggests that these mothers weren't monsters, but victims themselves, trapped in a horrific situation.
So even in these darkest moments of human cruelty, there's still a glimpse of humanity, of love trying to survive.
Absolutely. And that makes the tragedy even more profound. The chapter forces us to confront the brutal reality of war, how it can push people to the brink, shattering not just their bodies, but their very souls.
Yeah, and it's not just the physical suffering, is it? There's this profound sense of spiritual crisis that runs through the chapter, too. Like the very foundation of their faith has been shaken.
Exactly. Remember, the people of Jerusalem believed their city was impregnable, protected by God. It was a core tenet of what we might call Zion theology, this idea that Jerusalem, as God's chosen city, could never fall.
So when the city is destroyed, their entire worldview collapses. It's like the rug has been pulled out from under them.
The chapter really captures the shock and disbelief. It even quotes foreign kings who couldn't believe that Jerusalem's gates had been breached. It's a moment of collective trauma, a shattering of their faith and their sense of identity.
And in the midst of that trauma, they start looking for someone to blame, right?
Right, that's a natural human response to tragedy. We see it even today. When something terrible happens, we want to find a reason, someone to hold accountable.
And in this case, the blame falls on the priests and prophets, the very people who upheld this idea of Zion theology.
Yeah, it's a tragic irony. The priests and prophets, once revered as spiritual leaders, are now scapegoats, bearing the brunt of the people's anger and disappointment.
The chapter describes them wandering the streets, defiled and rejected, a stark contrast to their previous positions of authority. It's like the whole social order has been upended.
And this upheaval extends to the political realm, too. We see the complete collapse of royal theology, the belief in the Davidic dynasty, and the promise of an everlasting monarchy. Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, becomes a symbol of this shattered hope.
His fate is incredibly tragic, witnessing the slaughter of his sons before being blinded and taken captive. It's a brutal end to a lineage that was supposed to represent God's favor and blessing.
And it raises a crucial question for the people of Jerusalem. If everything they believed in has crumbled, where do they turn now? How do you find hope and meaning in the face of such profound loss?
That's a powerful question and one that we see them wrestling with throughout the chapter. But before we delve into that, I think it's important to explore this powerful imagery of color, or rather the lack of color that pervades this chapter.
That's a fascinating observation. The loss of color becomes a powerful metaphor for the emotional and spiritual emptiness that the people are experiencing.
It's like their world has been drained of all vibrancy and beauty, reflecting the internal emptiness they feel. Tell me more about how this plays out in the text.
Yeah, the chapter paints this stark contrast between the vibrancy of their former life and the bleakness of their present reality. You know, we hear about gold that's lost its luster, about these prized purple garments that are now gone, replaced by rags.
Yeah, and even the descriptions of their leaders, once so full of life and color, like their snow-white skin, their ruddy complexions, their sapphire-like hair, all of that fades into this dull, lifeless image. It's like their very essence has been bleached away.
Exactly. The color imagery really drives home the point that this isn't just about physical destruction, but a deep spiritual and emotional draining, too. It's as if grief itself has become this filter, muting the colors of their world and their very beings.
It reminds me of a line from Anne Ween's Lament, Psalm 9. Oh God, the world has been drained of color. The music has been turned off. The silent shroud covers any green that remains. All is gray and smells of death.
That's such a powerful image, isn't it? Weems perfectly captures the all-encompassing nature of their grief. It's not just about what they've lost materially, but how that loss affects their entire perception of the world.
Yeah. Makes you think about how grief operates in our own lives, too. We might lose a loved one or a job or a sense of security. And even though the world around us might still be full of color, our ability to see it, to feel its vibrancy, can be diminished.
It's a reminder that grief is a deeply personal and multifaceted experience. It touches every aspect of our being, physically, emotionally, spiritually, and it can fundamentally change how we interact with the world. You know, it can literally make everything feel dull and gray.
But even in the midst of this despair, this feeling of utter hopelessness, there's a surprising shift in the last few verses of the chapter. It's like a tiny spark of light in the darkness.
Ah, yes. The nevertheless moment. It's almost jarring, isn't it? After all the talk of suffering and loss, there's this sudden turn toward hope and future restoration.
And it starts with a message to Edom, Judah's enemy. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter Edom, the chapter says, but for you the cup will pass. You shall become drunk and strip yourself bare.
It's a powerful image, isn't it? It's like saying, you might be celebrating now, Edom, but your time is coming. You're going to experience the same kind of suffering that you inflicted on us.
So it's not just about Edom getting their comeuppance, but about that punishment paving the way for Judah's eventual restoration. It's almost like a cosmic balancing of the scales.
That's exactly it. This nevertheless moment points to a future where things will be set right, where Judah will be restored to its former glory. It's a reminder that even in the darkest of times, even when it feels like all hope is lost, there's still a possibility of redemption, of a brighter future.
But why Edom? Weren't there other enemies involved in the destruction of Jerusalem?
Edom's betrayal was particularly painful because they were considered kin, you know, descendants of Esau. Jacob's brother, Psalm 137, even talks about Edom urging the Babylonians to completely destroy Jerusalem.
So it was a betrayal on a much deeper level, not just a political or military defeat, but a familial betrayal that cut to the core of their identity.
And that's why Edom's downfall is so significant. It represents not just divine retribution, but also the reaffirmation of God's justice and faithfulness to his people. Even though he allowed Jerusalem to fall, he hasn't abandoned them. He will eventually set things right.
It's interesting, though, that this hope isn't presented as a certainty. It's more like a possibility, a potential outcome that seems to hinge on how the people respond.
You're picking up on something really important here. This chapter is part of a larger work, the Book of Lamentations, which is all about processing grief and finding a way back to God. This glimmer of hope, this nevertheless moment, is tied to the themes of prayer and repentance that run throughout the book. It's not just a passive waiting game. The people have a role to play in their own restoration.
So they're being offered a choice. They can wallow in their despair, cling to the broken pieces of their past, or they can choose hope, actively participate in their own healing by turning back to God. And that choice, as we'll see in the next chapter, hinges on their willingness to pray, to finally pour out their hearts to God and seek his mercy and guidance.
Exactly. This nevertheless moment acts like a crossroads. It's a turning point where they can either remain trapped in their grief or start to envision a new beginning.
It's fascinating how this chapter manages to hold both the depths of despair and this flicker of hope at the same time. It's such a raw and honest portrayal of the human experience of grief.
And I think that's what makes it so powerful. It doesn't shy away from the pain, the anger, the confusion, but it also offers a glimpse of something beyond the darkness. A reminder that even in the face of unimaginable loss, we always have the capacity to choose hope.
We've covered a lot of ground here. The vivid portrayal of suffering, the shattering of beliefs, the sense of utter loss and despair. And yet, in the midst of all that, there's this unexpected glimmer of hope, this nevertheless moment that points toward the possibility of restoration of a future where color and life return to Jerusalem. But as you said, it's not a guaranteed happy ending. It's an open invitation, a challenge to choose hope, to actively participate in their own healing by turning back to God. Yeah, it's like being handed a map in the middle of this vast, desolate landscape, and you can choose to stay lost in the wilderness, or you can use the map to find your way back home. It's a powerful message. I'm really curious to see how it unfolds in chapter 5.
We'll see if the people of Jerusalem are ready to embrace that map, so to speak. Are they ready to acknowledge their need for God's guidance? Are they ready to pray, to confess their failings, and to ask for forgiveness?
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it. It's not about God forcing them to return to Him. It's about them choosing to take those first steps to open themselves up to the possibility of healing and restoration.
And that requires humility, doesn't it? It requires acknowledging that they can't do this on their own. They need God's help.
Which is a hard pill to swallow, especially after experiencing such a devastating blow to their faith. Imagine believing that your city is invincible, divinely protected, only to see it crumble before your eyes. That's got to shake you to your core.
It's like everything you thought you knew about the world, about God, is suddenly called into question. It's a crisis of faith, a dark night of the soul.
And yet, even in that darkness, there's this glimmer of hope, this possibility of finding their way back to God, of rebuilding their lives in their city. It's a powerful message of resilience and the enduring power of faith, even in the face of unimaginable loss.
And it speaks to the human capacity for hope, doesn't it? Even when everything seems lost, there's still this part of us that yearns for something better, for a future where things can be made right.
So what are some of the key takeaway from our deep dive into Lamentations chapter 4? What do you hope our listeners walk away with?
Well, I hope they've gained a deeper understanding of the emotional and spiritual turmoil the people of Jerusalem experienced after the destruction of their city.
The chapter is a raw and honest depiction of grief, of the shattering of beliefs, and the struggle to find hope amidst despair.
It's also a reminder that grief isn't linear. It's messy and unpredictable, and it takes time. Sometimes you have to revisit that trauma to sit with the pain before you can even begin to heal.
And I hope they've been struck by the power of the nevertheless moment, that unexpected glimmer of hope that emerges from the darkness. It's a reminder that even in the face of unimaginable loss, there's always the possibility of restoration, of finding our way back to a place of wholeness.
But that restoration isn't passive. It requires us to make a choice to actively participate in our own healing by turning to God, by seeking His guidance and mercy.
And I think that's a powerful message for all of us, regardless of our faith background, whether we're facing a personal loss or a collective crisis. We always have that capacity to choose hope, to choose to believe that even in the darkest of times, a brighter future is possible. So to leave our listener with a final thought, if grief can strip away the color from life, as we've seen so vividly portrayed in chapter 4, what does it mean to find color again? How do we begin to rebuild, to find hope, and to restore vibrancy to our lives after experiencing profound loss? That's something I encourage you to reflect on as you continue your journey through the Book of Lamentations.